My name's Richard Dennis, Chief Economist at the Australia Institute, and you're listening to The Lucky Country, a weekly podcast brought to you by Schwartz Media, the publisher of The Monthly, The Saturday Paper, and by Australia's first fossil fuel-free super fund, Future Super. The Saturday Paper is my source of quality long-form journalism every weekend, and The Monthly is this country's best magazine of politics, culture and ideas. They even publish some of mine from time to time. This week I'll be talking to Jim Stanford about why wage growth is so slow in Australia, yet why the government's waging such a campaign against the unions. I'll also be talking to Jeremy Fernandez about the role of shame in our public debate and how hard it is for people to speak out when they've been subject to racial or sexual abuse. And I'll be joined by Chris Fry for our Sensible Centre segment, where we talk about gun law reform and how to fix American politics.
And let's also be very clear here, this is an important principle. We live in a system where someone makes an allegation, they've got to have some evidence to back it up. I get that the Constitution's caused great inconvenience to this government. The High Court will resolve it.
The presumption of innocence is not just a legal right, it's fundamental to the conduct of effective public debate and indeed effective democracy. It's not only juries that need to listen to the facts and avoid prejudging people. Voters need to give other citizens the benefit of the doubt too, to listen carefully and to judge slowly. But despite the widespread acceptance of the importance of the presumption of innocence, some politicians have spent decades encouraging their supporters to judge others.
We can't abolish poverty because poverty in part is a function of individual behaviour. We can't stop people drinking. We can't stop people gambling. We can't stop people having substance problems. We can't stop people from making mistakes that cause them to be less well off than they might otherwise be.
For decades, we've been told that unemployed people are dull bludgers, that asylum seekers are illegals, and that people with physical or mental illness are malingerers. While categorising, stigmatising and demonising groups of people that are unlikely to vote for you is a proven way to build profile and build a political base, it's also a proven way to create a divided society that's incapable of addressing complex issues. Put simply, it's hard to cut people some slack when you've been trained not to trust them. Which brings me to the citizenship debacle in the federal parliament.
The government will be proposing, or is proposing, that both the House and the Senate should resolve on additional means of transparency and disclosure on matters relating to citizenship.
The sad fact is that the government is reaping the harvest of the lack of trust that it itself has been sowing for years. Voters don't trust politicians because so many politicians have trained voters not to trust anybody. Throughout this series, the issue of shame has come up again and again. When we talked about mental health services, the NDIS, rape, sexual assault, housing, unemployment, all of those issues, when we talked about them, the fact that people often feel ashamed of their circumstance came up. There's no doubt that one of the drivers, perhaps one of the main drivers of that sense of shame, is that many people in Australia feel they'll be judged if they ask for help or support or explain what's happened to them. And there's also no doubt that one of the reasons so many people feel that they'll be judged is that so many of our politicians have not just been quick to judge others, but to encourage their supporters to judge others as well. But now that the boot is on the other foot, many of those same politicians who were so quick to call people dole bludgers and illegal immigrants are now quick to call on the public to cut the political class some slack. Have they got no shame? I have enormous sympathy for an unemployed person in their 50s who finds it difficult to go to their first job interview in decades. And I have enormous sympathy for someone experiencing mental illness who has to deal with the administrivia dished up by Centrelink at a point when they're stressed and uncertain. And I have enormous respect for people who've suffered sexual or racial violence and who have the strength to speak out about it in public. But I have neither sympathy nor respect for politicians who say that it's burdensome and excessive to ask them to provide basic information, especially since all of them have already signed a statutory declaration to that effect. To be clear, I think Australians should be willing to trust each other, cut each other some slack, and give each other the benefit of the doubt. But I also think that as Australians we should all be willing to take reasonable steps to meet the obligations that we have to other citizens. The question is, what's reasonable? The fact that the Turnbull government thinks it's okay to demand things of citizens that it won't demand of its own MPs shows that our lucky country really is only lucky for some. You can't have a democracy without politicians, and you can't expect democracy to work well unless we expect our politicians to work well. Believe it or not, we actually have to have high expectations of our politicians if we're to have high expectations of our democracy. Politicians have made us mistrustful of each other. Indeed, many politicians have made us mistrustful of politicians themselves. If we're going to turn this country around, if we're going to fix our public debate and get a parliament that works, it's pretty obvious what we need to do. We need to start trusting each other and indeed our politicians a little more, but at the same time, I think we have to be far harder on those in positions of authority who breach that trust. It's called accountability, and it's not a new idea.
Trade unions have a solemn, legal, moral, fiduciary duty to act in the interest of their members. And we've seen again and again, through the Hayden Royal Commission, and subsequently, the way unions have let their members down, how big Labor, big unions, have ignored the interests of their members and traded their rights away in return for payments from employers.
My first guest is Dr. Jim Stanford, Director of the Australia Institute's Centre for Future Work. Jim, thanks for joining us on The Lucky Country.
My pleasure, Richard.
Jim, we sit here in Australia today at a time of not only record low wage growth, but record low union membership as well. Are these things related?
Oh, they sure are, Richard, and you don't need a PhD to connect those two dots. The reality is, if workers are going to get a fair share of the wealth that our economy can produce, well, they have to have some institutional power to do so. You know, the whole idea of trickle down, that the wealth will automatically spread through society, has never been convincing, and recent history shows that theory is wrong. If we are going to have a more inclusive kind of growth where the benefits of new economic activity are shared, well, we have to have rules and regulations and policies and structures to make that happen. And none of those are more important than the idea of union membership and collective bargaining, so that workers can come together and approach the employer as a collective and thereby win a better share of the wealth. So we've seen a steady decline in union density, that is, union membership as a share of total employment in Australia, dating back now to the early 1990s. And coincident with that, we have seen a decline in the rate of wage growth and labor share of overall GDP.
Well, we'll come to the rules in a minute, but recently I saw the Retailers Association complaining that retail sales were down. It looked like being a terrible Christmas. Yet these are the same people that have opposed increases in wages and have pushed for the scrapping of penalty rates. Do you think there might be a link between the objective of driving wages down and the fact that retail sales are also growing very slowly?
Well, it is a clear case of poetic irony for sure. And we can expect a lot from the kind of self-serving lobby campaigns of business associations. But I guess we shouldn't expect consistency because the reality is retail sales are in terrible shape. In fact, we've had 5 months in a row now in Australia of zero growth in nominal retail spending. And everybody agrees that a key factor behind that is the unprecedented stagnation of wages. Real wages in Australia are not growing at all. They're actually shrinking now. That means nominal wages aren't keeping up with inflation. And on top of that, you've got an incredible degree of insecurity. This is a kind of a qualitative dimension to the wage problem that doesn't always get the attention it needs. Even if people are earning a decent wage, they're worried about how long that's going to continue. They're worried about how secure their job is. You've seen the growth of more insecure or casual type positions, the rise of the gig economy, and so on. So for all those reasons, it's not surprising that workers are sitting on their wallets. And now retailers are suddenly figuring out, hey, if people aren't getting paid, then they can't come shopping.
So the Treasurer thinks that wage growth is too low. The unions thinks wage growth's too low. You'd think they might be able to work together on these issues, but in fact, the government's raiding union offices and telling us unions are too powerful. Look, what's going on in Australia? What are the rules that need changing? Why is it that unions find it so hard to push for wage rises in Australia these days?
This will be surprising, I think, to a lot of your listeners, Richard, but Australia actually has some of the most repressive anti-union laws in the entire industrialized world. There once was a time when Australia was known as the land of a fair go for all, and unions were kind of accepted, even valued, as an important part of the whole process of managing income distribution and building an inclusive society. And that was true, say, up till the 1970s and 80s. But since then, there's been a concerted and long-lasting effort to undermine union power, to vilify unions themselves as institutions. That's why, you know, usually when you hear about unions in the media, you're hearing it in regards to some allegation or some police activity or these unbelievable raids that the government launched on one of the unions a couple of weeks ago. Things that really make you wonder how secure our basic freedoms are in Australia. And compared to other industrial countries, the status of collective bargaining in Australia is uniquely restricted, and as a result, unions have lost a huge amount of their ability to influence income distribution and support wages. You see this restrictiveness in all kinds of areas. One of them would be restrictions on unions getting organized. So there's incredibly tight restrictions on unions having access to workplaces, to go and talk to members, to investigate conditions, to try and build union membership. And that's part of the reason that you have things like wage theft become such a normalized part of Australia's economy, because employers know there's no chance that a union is going to come and investigate. The union can't even get in the front door. Then once you have a union, if you've managed to form one, the restrictions on what unions are allowed to do are incredibly severe, probably the most severe of any industrial country. You have limits on what unions are allowed to negotiate. So there's all kinds of issues around working time or the use of labor hire or the introduction of new technology that in many cases Australian unions are just prohibited from even talking about. Then if unions wanted to actually do something to support their position, take some kind of industrial action, you know, whether it be a slowdown or a work to rule or a work stoppage, again, the restrictions in Australia are uniquely severe and intrusive. I think it's funny because they often describe the current arrangement as one of labor market deregulation. The idea that you've freed the labor market from powers like unions that are going to somehow distort what goes on. In fact, it's not deregulation at all. It's micromanagement. The long arm of the nanny state is visible in every workplace in Australia, backed by 1,000 pages of detailed legislation in the Fair Work Act that limits and restricts what unions can do.
Takes a lot of regulation to deregulate the labor market, it seems.
And that's why that term deregulation really should be expunged from any kind of discussion about industrial relations in Australia. The end result has been a very steady decline in union membership. Another feature of Australia's rules, very distorted rules, is that any type of provision to provide for collective membership or collective dues collection in a workplace, anything like bargaining fees or fair share fees or closed shop arrangements or agency fees that are commonplace in most other countries are strictly prohibited here in Australia. And that means that if a union did manage against the odds to negotiate a decent collective agreement or enterprise agreement and increase wages, they have no ability to limit the benefits of that agreement just to union members. Anybody by law is entitled to exactly the same conditions that have been negotiated by the union. And that means there's an incredible financial disincentive for people to join the union because they know full well they're going to get whatever the union got anyway. And that free rider behavior, if you like, is generally prohibited elsewhere in the private sector. But in the case of unions, the government has made sure that this barrier to union membership is enshrined in law.
So last week we had Professor George Williams on saying that Australia was one of was the only democracy in the world to not have a Bill of Rights or a Charter of Rights. And you're telling us now that we've got some of the most onerous, if not the most onerous, anti-union laws in the democratic world. Do you think, in addition to the laws, that we've stigmatized unions? Is this attack on unions common in Canada or North America, where you're from?
Well, the connection between not having a Charter of Rights and the attacks on labor rights is also not coincidental. In many other countries, certainly in Canada, where I'm from, many of those anti-union restrictions on what unions can do, what unions can negotiate, on what unions can say, let alone the right to take collective action, those all would have been thrown out in an instant through a human rights case. But because Australia doesn't have those fundamental protections, the government has been able to get away with it. And your point about vilification is entirely correct. And I think it does reflect, in a way, the structure and, I guess I could say, dysfunction of Australian politics. Rightly or wrongly, unions have been associated with the Labor Party. And so the government, the coalition government of the day, is attacking the Labor Party when they're attacking unions. It's a proxy way of carrying on the same very heated partisan debate, which has sort of paralyzed policymaking in Australia. And that's why it's increasingly laughable, you know, even though wages are stagnant and union power has actually been very largely eroded, you still have a government that's in its own trouble launching a big attack on unions because this is how they play politics. The economic foundation for their argument that unions are too powerful and have to be reined in is laughable. The proof is in the pudding in terms of the stagnation of wages and the erosion of union membership. But the government still sees this as a handy hot button to push in the hyper-partisan atmosphere of Australian politics. And in this regard, I think unions are collateral damage of the battle between the two major parties. And somehow the union movement has to rise above that and show that unions fulfill an essential economic and social function as an institution that allows us to distribute the wealth more equally, regardless of which political party is in power at any given day.
Well, I guess on any given day, the government simultaneously says unions are weak and irrelevant, yet so strong that they're ruining the economy. I guess it's not just the peak bodies that struggle for consistency. Jim Stanford, thanks for joining us on The Lucky Country.
Thank you, Richard.
That was Dr. Jim Stanford, director of the Centre for Future Work. My next guest is broadcaster and journalist Jeremy Fernandez. Jeremy, thanks for joining us on The Lucky Country.
Good to talk to you, Richard.
So it was widely reported a few years ago that you were travelling on a bus with your daughter when unfortunately someone else on the bus decided to make you the recipient of an incredible racial stream of abuse. What was going through your head when that happened?
You know, the first thing that came to my mind was my daughter's safety and my safety, because it wasn't, you know, just sort of verbal abuse. It was threats of, you know, being physically punched, taken out and thrown off the bus. That was my most immediate concern. And then secondarily, the safety of everyone else on the bus, because there was a situation developing in an enclosed space, in a moving vehicle, that could potentially escalate very quickly. I didn't know where it was going. And so primarily, it was one of fear, a feeling of fear, and respond in the most diplomatic and defusive sort of way.
That seems like an incredibly thoughtful response to such a situation. I'm sure a lot of people might just respond either in fear or anger. I mean, you were thinking about your daughter, you were thinking about the other passengers. What about the bus driver? Were they of any help to you in that situation?
Well, he wasn't really aware of what was going on at the back of the bus because the commotion, you know, sort of escalated over a period of several minutes. And I think, you know, there's a degree to which bus drivers see this sort of stuff taking place all the time. It may not be racial abuse. It may be just some commotion to do with the bus. And they've, you know, they're in control of a moving vehicle. So I wasn't necessarily expecting him to step in at any early stage. It was when he stopped the bus and said to me, "You're aggravating this woman. You need to get off." And I thought, why do I need to get off? Why is this on me to fix the situation when all I was doing was sitting here and taking my daughter to daycare? And that was, you know, one of the most confronting things about the whole experience was that I was in the situation where I felt I was, you know, setting an example not only for my daughter, but saying something about my own identity and my right to be there and my right to sit on a bus peacefully. and not feel that I was then responsible for fixing the situation that I didn't even create.
Now, in Australia, we often tell ourselves that, you know, we're a friendly culture, that while there might be incidents of racism, we're certainly not a racist culture. This is what we tell ourselves. So when people experience this, they're often told, oh, you probably misunderstood, or, you know, I'm sure it wasn't that bad. Maybe someone else was just having a bad day. Did, when you started to talk about this, did people take you seriously? And
you know, you're absolutely spot on. That is exactly the reason why I decided to put it down on paper, put it on social media, because I've been told throughout my life that often that I was being too sensitive, that I'd misunderstood something, or that I'd completely misread a situation. And I was kind of sick of it, because in many ways it wasn't just about this particular bus incident. It was about a lifetime of copying this sort of stuff. Admittedly, I haven't been physically threatened that many times in my life, but it was the case of on that day, I just didn't feel like turning the other cheek. Now, I was born in Malaysia. I came to Australia when I was 13. I've experienced racism there as much as I have here. To say that Australia is a racist country or not a racist country, or that, you know, that white people are more racist than other people, I think, you know, my view is that racism exists everywhere in various forms. And so, and what's interesting about this situation on this particular bus was that I had chosen to live in a fairly multicultural sort of neighbourhood because I could feel like I wasn't the other. And most of the people on the bus were people of colour of some sort, people of diverse backgrounds as well. And they felt, you know, equally that they didn't have a right to stand up and that they didn't want to escalate the situation by stepping in either. So, you know, there's a lot of nuance here and a lot of intersectionality when it comes to sort of deciding who gets to speak up, who doesn't get to speak up, and in what context you do speak up.
Well, it's interesting hearing you talk about that, because obviously a lot of women in recent times have said, look, I've made my feelings about sexism known before. I've complained about the behaviour of a man in the workplace, and I've been told I was being sensitive or taking it out of context. But obviously since the Harvey Weinstein issue's blown up, I think a lot less people are telling women that they misunderstood. Do you see parallels between that?
Oh, 100%. You know, one of the really interesting things in this whole debate, whether you're talking about racism or sexism or, you know, sexual assault and rape in the Weinstein case, you cannot overestimate how difficult it is to come forward when you've been receiving this sort of abuse and you're not really that sure whether people are going to believe you. I mean, certainly my experience was that, you know, having had a lifetime of people sort of diminishing my experience as a person of colour, then risking speaking out on the off chance that someone might believe in this particular circumstance, I was actually quite surprised at the sort of coverage it got, because one of the reasons I wrote about my experience was just to put it on the record to say, I'm not copying this today. I am sick of this. I have a right to be here. And it was also to put on the record on behalf of people everywhere who don't have that voice to speak up, to say this sort of stuff happens all the time. It doesn't happen to privileged newsreaders sitting on a bus. It happens all the time, everywhere, around the world. And I was surprised that people were surprised. I was surprised at the positive feedback I got. I was surprised at the negative feedback that I got, that I was blowing things out of proportion. And again, it wasn't really about that particular bus incident, because I got off. I was terribly embarrassed about the fact that I was so emotionally cut up about it. I sort of, you know, walked away to a park and I had a bit of a cry, I have to admit. I just had to let the tension out of my body. And then I had to think what I wanted to do. And I just decided I wanted to write about it. And so it was a matter of putting it on the record and hoping that someone would believe me because I had made a public declaration of some sort, but I had no idea what the response was going to be.
Well, thank you for doing that, and thank you for telling us about how hard it was for you now, because we recently had Karen Middleton on the show who expressed very similar sentiments to you in terms of when she wrote about her experience of sexual harassment in the workplace. She too said she was overwhelmed and surprised with how much positive feedback she got, but again, also the fear that people aren't going to believe you. As a journalist, how do you see the media media's role in reporting these issues? Does the media struggle to talk about racism or sexism without someone willing to put their face forward and say, here's exactly what happened to me? Because, as you said, that's a very difficult thing to expect people to do.
You know, there's a very interesting trend that's taken place over the course of the last 20 years that I've been a journalist, and that is that when I started out, and you would be in the newsroom and there was a report of an incidence of violence of some sort, you know, you'd send a journalist or a camera crew to the scene, and then word would come back that it was, and I'm quoting here, just a domestic. It was just a domestic. So it was, in that situation, yes, there may have been violence, yes, there may have been a siege situation of some sort, but it was just a domestic. We are going to pull out of it and we're not going to report it because we best leave this situation to those people to sort out. What's changed over the course of the last 20 years is that we are accepting those stories as not something to be hidden away, that those people who are in that situation actually need help and they need the coverage. Now, one of the difficulties we have, and I acknowledge, you know, there's this sort of paradox in the media that we want to cover these issues, but we need people to put their face and name to it quite often. And the reason for that is that we're seeking some degree of authenticity. It's very difficult to report a story when you can't report the major characters involved in the story. But what we can do is to report the trends that we're seeing and to look to researchers to try to quantify some of these things. And it's very difficult to tell some of these stories if someone won't come forward. One of the amazing things, though, that we are seeing, particularly in regards to sexual assault in the workplace, sexual harassment in the workplace, is that when one person is brave enough to come forward and to wear the shame, it empowers other people to do the same. And we've seen that in incidences of racism where someone is being harassed on public transport. And, you know, all it takes is one person to step up and it empowers everyone else to take a stand as well. And I inherently believe that most people are sort of quite decent and would step up. But again, there is that fear of escalating a situation, not just for the person directly involved, but for everyone in that room, on the bus or wherever it is at the same time.
Well, in this series, we've talked about shame quite a bit. It's come up when we've talked about mental health, when we've talked about disability, rape and domestic violence, and even access to housing and welfare. Shame comes up again and again. So thank you for being brave enough to speak out about the situation that you were placed in. But also thanks very much for coming onto the Lucky Country to talk about us, because as you said, and when people do speak up, it makes it a lot easier for other people to realise that what they've experienced isn't okay and that it's okay for them to speak up too.
Absolutely, Richard. It's good to talk to you. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Jeremy. That was Jeremy Fernandez. Now I'm joined by Chris Fry in our regular search for the Sensible Centre. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Hello, Richard. Thanks for having me.
Look, unfortunately, we've just heard the terrible news that there's been another mass shooting in the US, this time more than 20 people in Texas. Why is it, do you think, that right-wingers in America are so determined for people to have the right to kill so many fellow citizens?
Mate, I just don't know. It's just got to be a unique United States phenomenon, I think. You know, it's not in New York and it's not in California. It's not in the places that are like Australia. It's sort of everywhere else. There's got to be something to do with education. It's just a cultural phenomenon that, frankly, I think no one else in the world much can understand, and it certainly bewilders me.
Now, obviously, in Australia, after our last and indeed our biggest massacre at Port Arthur, it was the newly elected John Howard, a well-known conservative, that took the issue of gun reform and really drove it, not just through the public debate, but through the parliament. In doing so, however, of course, he made himself a lot of enemies on the right of Australian politics. In Australia, is restricting people's rights to own machine guns a libertarian issue, or is it a safety issue to take those guns out of the community?
Well, fortunately, I was actually worked in the parliament at the time, and I was there, and Kim Beazley was the leader of the opposition, and he immediately offered bipartisan support. And that just meant that whatever problems there were was sort of whispered, I think, in the coalition party room rather than acted out. But we don't have the curse of the Bill of Rights. That's one of the reasons I don't support that silly American model. The Second Amendment, it doesn't even allow people to arm themselves. It's just that's a myth. But nonetheless, it provides a sort of historical rallying call for now this hideous sort of movement in the States. Fortunately, we do not have that here. One of the good things about the Westminster system, I think. I know people who fire guns and they like that, and that's fine. But I don't know anybody who believes that, you know, having a gun in your house is somehow improves liberty or freedom, and I doubt you would either. It's a particularly thick American phenomenon.
I've certainly heard David Lionhelm tell me that we can't have a free country if we don't have enough guns to protect our freedom. But I'm interested in your thoughts about a Bill of Rights. We had George Williams on last week saying he thinks a Bill of Rights would be a great idea. Do you have a problem with them in principle, or just the American idea that one of those rights is the right to buy armor-piercing bullets?
A bit of both, I think. The only way, in my view, that rights are ever really enforced in the universal sense, and that's what I think you're arguing for, is it's a cultural thing. It's a voluntary compliance thing by both the community and by the government. You know, we are not paranoid of government in Australia, and nor should we be. It's not oppressing us, and it's not going to take away our freedom in the way that the 17th and 18th century, some of the philosophers were worried about. The trouble with the Bill of Rights is, or any Bill of Rights in my view, is that it is always used by the rich and powerful and by the guilty to lessen their harms. You know, I don't object to anyone having fundamental rights, but putting a law in place doesn't actually provide that. What it does is provide defence attorneys with clever ways to get guilty people off.
This episode we've talked a fair bit about shame, Chris, but the idea with shame presumably is that people have it and in turn it affects their behaviour. But when it comes to the gun lobby in America, it doesn't seem to work. What would you say to that?
I completely agree with you. It just bewilders me that someone can shamelessly continue to defend their commercial interests in the wake of you know, dozens or indeed probably hundreds of these mass shooting incidents. It's incredible. And the thing that it shows to me is that the normal rules just don't apply here. It just doesn't matter how many times this is going to happen. The corrupt people in the Congress and the lobby that funds and nurtures them is never going to stop. And the normal human decency, which shame obviously is part of, suspended there. And I find it weird. And for that reason, I've actually been toying with what are frankly probably pretty stupid ideas. Maybe we want to explore it at another time, but possibly here some market signals might be the only way. A friend of mine works in gun control here, and he fails, as he laments all the time, but he had a view about, for example, having compulsory insurance on all firearms, and the premiums would be set partly by assisting the victims of gun crime. And that might be a way where the market would really price in a lot of expense for owning guns.
I think it's an interesting thought, and I think it seems obvious to me that in America, one of the major groups that would benefit from gun control would be the health insurance industry, who must spend a fortune paying doctors to patch people who've been shot up.
Exactly. Not to mention, obviously, you know, county hospitals and public hospitals to the extent they exist. But, yeah, it's
Well, there you go. I think we might have just managed gun control in the US with a political strategy. Chris Fry, thanks for joining us on The Lucky Country at the Sensible Centre yet again.
Thank you for having me, Richard. Bye-bye.
Thanks. That brings us to the end of this week's episode and to the end of our first season. I'll be back before Christmas with a couple of bonus episodes, including an episode focusing on the questions from you, the listeners, that we haven't had time to get to in each episode. The Lucky Country is a Schwartz Media production, brought to you by Australia's first fossil fuel-free super fund, Future Super. Thanks for all of your support. The show's produced by Andy Hazel. I'm Richard Dennis. I really do think we live in a lucky country. I just think we could make it better if we paid a bit more attention. Thanks for listening.